Peru is a Latin American country on the move. The economy is strong. The gross domestic product grew by more than 5% last year, while inflation was well under 4%. And Peruvian economists point to the growing number of American fast food chains and other foreign investment as an indication that other countries believe in the stability of the country. But Peru is a young democracy, and there is still the potential for political turmoil. The current president, Alejandro Toledo, will step down when his term ends next year, and a new president will take over the country in 2006. I'm Matt Stenzelin, one of 10 University of Illinois journalism students who recently traveled to Peru as part of Professor Nancy Benson's international reporting course. As foreign correspondents in training, we explored Peru's Inca history and Spanish colonial past, but we also talked to Peruvians about how they envision the future of their country. During this hour, we'll examine where Peru might be headed and what might be blocking the country's path to prosperity. Stay tuned for another hour of Assignment Peru, right after this news update from National Public Radio. Many Peruvians are pleased with the improvements in their country's economy, but they say there are still many problems in Peru that need to be solved, problems that will likely keep Peru from becoming a developed country for at least another 30 years. I'm Matt Stenzelin, one of 10 University of Illinois journalism students who recently traveled to Peru as part of Professor Nancy Benson's international reporting class. You're listening to Assignment Peru, a radio documentary produced by journalism students. Peru's economy is one of the strongest in the region, and yet more than half the population is malnourished. Children outside the capital, Lima, often have to work to help support the family, so they're too tired and too hungry to learn much in school. Peruvians say these problems are not getting solved because economic growth in the country is based on foreign investments that don't generate a lot of jobs for Peruvians. And they say foreign ownership of industries and businesses means profits are taken out of Peru rather than being reinvested to improve the country. Abby Rhodes has more on the plight of Peruvians who often find it hard to compete with foreign businesses.
Cecilia Bueno Shimon owns a small hotel in Cusco. As the gateway to Machu Picchu, Cusco is one of the country's most popular tourist destinations. Shimon and her husband opened the hotel 9 years ago during a period of prosperity in Peru. The 1980s were a tumultuous time for the country as terrorism destroyed public confidence and discouraged potential investors. The 1990s brought the decline of the terrorist threat, and since then, the country's government and economy have stabilized, allowing for safe investment. But Peruvian business owners like Shimon are struggling to survive in an environment that is now attracting a lot of foreign competition.
All here in Cusco is foreign investment. You see the airplanes, when you come, it's foreign investment. The train that you're going to Machu Picchu is a foreign investment. Some hotels here, a lot of hotels are foreign investments. The restaurants, for the bars, foreign investments, no?
Small businesses like the tiny restaurants, bars, and convenience stores that line Cusco's historic Plaza de Armas are likely to be owned by Peruvians. But larger investments like hotels are nearly all foreign owned. Shimon estimates that 70% of Cusco's hotels are owned by outside investors with deep pockets that allow them to provide lower prices. And Shimon says that's discouraging Peruvians from investing in their own country. Although Peru's economy is improving, many potential business owners believe they'll be better off taking their money elsewhere.
The people of Peru that have money don't have it here in Peru. They take it out of the country because they don't have confidence. Or people that are finishing studying here, they finish the university, they go out, they go to the United States, or they try to go to Europe to have a better vision of their lives, no?
Shimon believes the government offers more incentives to foreign investors and feels local businesses are taxed unfairly when the government needs money to relieve social pressures. But the editor of Semana Economica, one of Peru's leading economic publications, says the system treats foreign and domestic businesses equally. Gonzalo Zagara says when the government raises taxes on businesses, all investors are required to pay up.
The law doesn't discriminate between who the investor is, who the owner of any business is. So, of course, I agree with her that all social pressures, or most of the social pressures, are being satisfied, even when some of them are not fair. And that must be done with the fiscal wealth, or with a fiscal income. And that comes from taxes. Local and foreign investors have to pay those taxes. Basically, there's no a rule that creates a difference between foreign and local investors, favoring the foreigners, not at all.
Many Peruvians complain that foreign business owners take their earnings back to their own country, so local people do not benefit from the investment. With thousands of tourists visiting Cusco and Machu Picchu daily, foreign hotels and restaurants are making big money off of Peru, but giving back very little. Zegarra says this is simply the result of a more globalized market economy, something many Peruvians are just not used to.
I think the mere fact that there's business going on benefits Cusco or the zone where the business is being developed. No one comes here and open a business in order to make gifts or grants of money to the people living there unless you're willing to do that expressly, right? Which would be an NGO or whatever. So if you're doing business, what you want is profit. And once you have profit, you have two possibilities. You reinvest it in the same business or you take it home. So the mere fact that they're taking some of the profit, not all, back home is a natural consequence of doing business.
Zegarra adds that the jobs created by these investors is a benefit in itself and has market value. Although local entrepreneurs like Cecilia Shimon worry that all Peruvian business owners in Cusco will eventually be driven out by international companies, Zegarra says there are examples throughout Peru of national investors holding their own against foreign competition. He points specifically to retail chains in Lima, where two Peruvian companies dominate the supermarket sector. The Wong Group, which owns the popular supermarket chain Ewong, started business in Peru in 1942 and now owns over 30 super and hypermarkets in Lima. Supermercados Peruanos is Peru's second largest supermarket chain. The business was owned by a Dutch company for many years, but was recently purchased by Peruvian investors.
So it's not true that the foreign investors are always winning. Not at all. It's a great challenge of becoming modern and globalized and competitive. That's it. We shouldn't be traumatized about and have the idea that we can do it. I mean, there's plenty of Peruvian business that prove that we Peruvians can do it well in the market, in all kinds of businesses. I mean, there's no reason why to believe that we are less than foreign investors are. We're not.
But ironically, those successful Peruvian-owned hypermarkets may eventually drive out smaller businesses in the city. These megastores, where consumers have access to a wide variety of products with quality guarantees, are new to Peru, where shopping has traditionally taken place in outdoor markets or small corner stores. The presence of stores like Ewong, Santa Isabel, Metro, and Totus are changing the consumer culture in Lima and starting to take business away from the street markets and smaller grocery stores. The stores offer a high-quality, modern, and innovative option for Peruvian consumers. But Universidad Católica professor of sociology Gonzalo Porto Carrero fears the megastores may be growing too rapidly for small businesses to keep up.
Around 10 or perhaps 15 years ago, supermarkets sold 15% of the total sales of fruits, vegetables, and so on. Now they must be selling around 50%. So there's a big leap forward, and that means that the number of small businesses that are profitable have diminished dramatically. That's the problem of globalization, that globalization in our country means that there's a concentration of wealth and income, and there are sectors that are excluded from these benefits, and they are losing, and they don't have jobs.
But in a country where the poor dramatically outnumber the affluent, shopping in supermarkets and hypermarkets isn't an option for over half of the population. The government divides Lima's economic hierarchy into sections and labels them with letters A through E, with A being the richest and E the poorest. The megastores target economic levels A through C, while sections D and E are largely left out of the game. Although hypermarkets are able to offer very low prices, their locations are not ideal for people living on the poor outskirts of the city. Ivan Alvarez is a market researcher for Supermercados Peruanos. He says many Peruvians cannot afford the taxi fare or the time to travel to a hypermarket across town when they can walk a block to the nearest corner market. For that reason, small markets are still important.
I think that they will survive because the people to go through the hypermarket has to take the bus or walk. It's different in the States. You take your car and you go, and there is no problem.
And Zagara says the progression of Lima's retail food sector is encouraging smaller markets to find innovative ways to compete with their larger competitors.
These grocery stores have a chance to get modernized themselves, and that's also happening right now. There's some people, some clever people that have found that they have a lot of potential, and they're creating like a chain of partnerships among grocery stores, the biggest, in order to have more negotiation power with the wholesalers. So this modernization can be achieved by everyone that's really wanting to follow the trend, right?
The customer service director for Wong Group, Javier Laus, says his company's success in the market does not necessarily mean small businesses will be hurt.
When you open a big business, the small ones, the majority of them, close down. In Peru, this is just now happening, but this has already happened all over the world. But people get a little scared, but it's not going to eliminate everything. There's 84 to 85% of clients who still shop in small markets or open air markets. So we only cover 25% of the minority of the sales. So you have to keep that in mind.
But hypermarkets in particular are starting to spread to lower income portions of Lima. Sociology professor Gonzalo Porto Guerrero fears that these huge stores where customers can buy food, clothing, housewares, and even do banking and dry cleaning are pressuring poor Peruvians to live above their means.
That's just the main consequence. People trying to live as if they were in the United States. This is a very prestigious place in low income sectors, no? Are seen as something that the future is there in the mega store.
Alvarez says many consumers consider trips to the supermarket or hypermarket a social event. For some, shopping in these stores is all about image.
It's tangible proof that you are improving. You have a better quality of life because you go to that place.
Supermarkets and hypermarkets have recently started accepting major credit cards as well as store credit cards. This offers consumers whose income requires them to live day by day the opportunity to make larger purchases and pay their debt over a period of time. A market researcher for Wong Group, Flavia Maggi, says the credit card option also allows lower income customers to shop in their stores.
The access to credit changed a lot of things. Now they realize that if they go to Plaza Vea and all these supermarkets where they can buy with these credit cards, they can have a larger size with a smaller price per milliliters.
Maggi and others say the megastores have helped empower Peruvian consumers and generate excitement about a more modern society. Most consumers who can afford to shop in these stores hope the rapidly expanding chains will build new supermarkets close to their homes. Customer Dahlia Condor says she still shops in street markets when she only needs one or two items, but otherwise prefers the advantages of more formal hypermarkets.
I like to shop here because it's safe, nobody is pickpocketing me, and I get credit. I always find everything in the same place. I don't have to look for it. The products are good, and I always find what I like.
Professor Porto Guerrero says it's this infatuation with progression and first world ideals that causes consumers to overlook the fact that small businesses may get lost in the shuffle.
In Lima, there has been almost no resistance. These shopping centers are seen as something very fashionable, something very desirable for the people of the middle and low sectors, lower class sectors. There is no sensitivity to this issue. It's not considered as something problematic, it's considered as something just desirable, as a sign of a modernity. I think it's a very problematic situation.
Porto Carrero's concern is that while hypermarket and supermarket stores are credited with creating hundreds of jobs, most positions do not pay well enough to lift Peruvians out of poverty. But according to Maggi and Alvarez, the benefits of these stores outweigh the consequences, and the super and hypermarket industry is just one example of how Peruvian society is advancing.
They changed our lives because they introduce high standards, high quality also in products, and everything in one place. So now you have to go. You go to one place and you can buy a television or crackers. So you can buy everything. So simplify our lives.
We have a new culture, a new consumer with a very progressive point of view about life. They, 20 years ago, maybe they were very poor, and now they have a much more wealthy life, and they are proud of them, of that. They are very proud, and they want to keep going this achievement. It's a change.
The retail sector in Lima is another example of how the country is becoming more attractive to outside investors. Chileans own the hypermarket Totus, which so far poses little threat to the success of its Peruvian-owned competitors. Zagara argues that more business is always better in a developing country, and it makes no difference where the business is coming from.
There's no reason why a number of businesses have to be owned by Peruvians. There's no reason why all of the business here must be owned by Peruvians. There's no reason why half of them or 70% of them. It's just the market working. And nationality is becoming less and less important today.
Meanwhile, back in Cusco, Cecilia Shimon fears doing business in competition with foreign investors will only get more difficult. She and her husband have adapted their hotel to meet the changing demand, offering larger rooms, more lounge areas, and better overall service. And though times are tough, they want to stay put in Peru.
We are thinking about other things to make when this is all paid, to make another things. Because we love our country and we want to stay here. Now we don't want to go to another place, no? So we will try to continue, no?
Economists like Gonzalo Zagara say that as long as small business owners and Peruvian companies are willing and able to follow the market trend, the diversity of the country's social and economic system and its newly stable government will allow for all types of business to flourish. Still, others worry that as the business sector pushes Peru into the first world, half of Peru's population, those too poor to take advantage of the changing times, may get left behind. Abby Rhodes reporting.
Nearly 55% of Peruvians live on less than $2 a day. For these people, putting food on the table is the biggest concern. Not everyone is waiting for the government to step in and make their lives better. Marianne Pison talked with some Peruvians who are finding innovative ways to try and keep young kids from going hungry.
Cecilia Soto works in a community kitchen or comedor popular one day every 2 weeks. Community kitchens are an integral part of poor communities. Women, who cook at them, are guaranteed a number of meals per week for their families. Helping feed the community in turn helps Soto make sure she, her husband, and son have enough to eat. The comedor in her neighborhood, however, is not the full-fledged community kitchen. It just serves milk and breakfast to local children for right now.
We eat whatever there is to eat. Sometimes we go to the comedor popular that is further down the mountain from where we live.
The Soto family lives in the Lima slum of San Juan de Miraflores, family members which work hard to get by. Celia's husband, Jose, works odd construction jobs when he can get them. He earns about 15 soles, or $5, per day when he works. But when you account for days when there is no work, his salary averages closer to 7 soles per day. That's just a little more than the government-defined poverty line of 5 soles a day, or about $150 a month. More than half the population in Peru lives below the poverty line. Like the Sotos, those who manage to make poverty wages have a hard time surviving. Carolina Sanchez is director of Solidaridad en Marcha, a nonprofit organization that works in the neighborhood.
The minimum wage does not provide properly for a family or even for a single person. It isn't even enough money for a person to be able to afford to study.
An education is seen as a key to improving conditions for those who live in neighborhoods like the Sotos. Many fled to Lima from the jungle and mountains in the late 1980s and early 1990s to flee a terrorist group called the Shining Path, which controlled much of the countryside. But the communities they founded, the Barrios Jóvenes, had to be carved out of mountains in the outskirts of Lima, and a lot of them still lack electricity, running water, plumbing, and they don't have easy access to schools or doctors.
Most major problem is that people don't have money. With the pollution and the climate, the way it is here, people get sick and there's no way for them to pay for what they need to get better.
Rubén Aguilar Rodríguez agrees with Soto about problems in the community. Aguilar Rodríguez, who is part of the unofficial government for San Juan de Miraflores, is in charge of a block where about 1,000 people, 72 families in all, live. Despite the work ahead, Aguilar Rodríguez has high hopes for the area he has called home for the past 5 years.
It's going to take a long time to do all the work. For example, we lack various things here. We need different, various things. For example, for say a medical center, we don't have what we need to make a playground. We need to see all those little things here, a school, a community's kitchen, a restaurant, a series of things.
This unofficial government is a way that the poor work together to make their lives better.
It would take a long time, at least for now. We have been here for more than 5 years. For more than 5 years we have been here. It's because of these roads that we have worked on. We have worked hard to make everything we have here. It's arduous labor. The whole community has worked for it. We broke all the rocks by hand, all the way up the mountain. Therefore, everything we've done has been because of our arduous work. Sunday through Sunday, we work together to make these things for the community together.
Aguilar Rodriguez says that it's necessary for people to work together because the needs of their community are often ignored by outsiders.
It is very important for people to see how they live here, what sorts of things they need, because through what one sees, let's say the pueblos, the more marginalized pueblos, in the poor pueblos, other countries need to know about the problems that exist in this country, because if a nation of people are alone in this, in immense poverty, we need others to help us, to cooperate.
One group that does not ignore this section of the slums is Solidaridad en Marcha, a private charity that receives funding from the Catholic Church. The group delivers rice, powdered milk, a cooking stove, and kerosene to the community kitchen. The organization's truck is also used to transport the sick to hospitals. Lourdes Lopez, a doctor who works for the charity, says their needs continue to grow because although the threat of terrorism has subsided, people continue to move to Lima from poorer parts of the country in search of a better life.
The people prefer to be here than to be in their pueblos. Here they can have televisions, they can have radios. In Lima, they can have access to all the means of communication and the mass media.
Solidaridad's mission is to educate people on proper nutrition and sanitation. It also tries to teach young mothers, whose average age is 14, to keep from giving birth to more children than they can afford to feed. Director Carolina Sanchez says vocational education is also important.
When people come here, they have to learn how to do more occupations. There are people who never bothered to learn how to do anything specifically. They just care about earning money any way they can. They just get temporary jobs. Like someone will ask them to paint a house, and they'll paint a house. Someone will ask them to fix a piece of furniture, and they'll fix a piece of furniture. There is another distinct group of people who don't have a specific job, and they go out and sell candy in the streets, or just go out and see whatever they can find.
This is the case for Cecilia Soto, who quit school after the eighth grade. She and her young son are lucky that her husband can support them. For many families, the only way to make ends meet is to have every family member, even children, work outside the home. In touristy areas of the country like Cusco, this often means that children sell small items or beg in the street, says Darren Chambers, the director of Bruce Peru in Cusco.
And it's quite heartbreaking. The only different night, I think it was Saturday, the volunteers and I went out. And I came back about 2 in the morning, and we saw two of our children in the plaza. So we just gave them money to get home, because they're not allowed to go home until they've got a certain amount of money, because their mum won't allow it. So we gave them the amount they needed, we put them in a taxi and we put them home.
Often the money the children bring home means the difference between the family having enough to eat or having to go hungry. Right now, Bruce Peru, a charity that works with street children and was founded by an American ex-priest, is tutoring 40 children, teaching them to read and write in Spanish and teaching them basic math and English so they can pass the school entrance exam. Chambers says it's hard to know whether this is the best thing for the children who work in the street. Chambers doesn't know how many of the children will remain in school.
Always raise that money so they'll just go home and just face the consequences when they go home. Well, it depends. Like, I know this is some of our families, the mothers are quite drunk a lot, so they'll probably hit them or, you know, not exactly be treated that great. Also, they won't eat because they won't be able to buy food. So, it's many, many different reasons.
18-year-old Angelo Jerez-Peda knows what it's like to drop out of school and begin work early. He stopped attending school 5 years ago so that he could help out his aunt and uncle who take care of him.
Right now I am trying to pursue studying car mechanics. It pays well. I work construction jobs when I can get them. I've been doing this for a while now. It makes it easier on my family with me working too.
But starting work at age 13, like Angelo did, is far from the norm. The majority of children who work in the streets or other endeavors start at a far younger age. According to Maria Mosquera La Rosa, the executive director of Acción por los Niños, a children's rights organization, in the vast majority of cases, requiring young kids to work is not considered to be child abuse.
The worst situations for working children can be found in Lima, which makes sense because it is the biggest city in the country, but situations are also bad for children working in the mining industries and in port towns. There is a custom that children from poor towns in outlying areas of the country are brought to Lima. They are adopted by someone known as a madrina, an aunt. Then they are exploited and made to work in poor conditions, often as house servants or in the garment industry.
And severe poverty often leads to other problems. Ramon Cisneros Rios, a programming official with the World Food Program, a United Nations organization that provides food aid, says that although people don't usually starve to death, malnutrition leads to other serious difficulties.
Often children's growth is severely stunted both mentally and physically due to malnutrition. Not eating properly can also lead to earlier deaths. There's a good example of how you can see the importance of nutrition. For example, if one child from a family grows up in the mountains in a poor area and doesn't get the nutrition they need, and their sibling grows up somewhere where they do get what they need to eat, one sibling will be far taller than the other.
Like others who are fighting for a brighter future for the children of Peru, Cisneros is clear about the path that needs to be followed.
What we really need to focus on is nutrition and education. We need to make a priority of making sure that children up to 3 years or up to 6 years are fed adequate diets, and we must make sure that they are being educated so they can make a better future for our country.
I'm Marianne Pison, reporting.
As you just heard, it can be a real struggle for Peruvian women to find the money to feed their kids. Some disadvantaged women are overcoming the social and economic barriers, making great strides in a country where tradition has worked against them. They are starting their own businesses. Jenny Mulkowski reports.
Many Latin American women find themselves stuck in the macho culture of Peru, keeping them away from the workplace and other important public roles. The culture breeds discrimination against Peruvian women, but a volunteer group of female lawyers called DEMUS is helping women to fight this inequality. According to DEMUS, women represent almost half of the population of Peru. DEMUS says they don't have equal access to resources or power. Luis Torrejon is a historian and professor of the Universidad del Pacífico in Lima. He says in the 1970s, women began to participate in the labor market and political scene. But he says there's still a large sense of patriarchal status in the country, which leads not only to discrimination of women, but discrimination based on where those women live.
First, in our country, we have a strong male chauvinism feeling, but at least there are legal mechanisms to fight this. Second, there is racism in Peru, but it is not only because of discrimination, it is combined with where you are from. And discrimination is stronger when the person is from the Andean region or rural areas.
Torrejon also says the number of children these women are having is keeping them at home, away from the workplace, confirming the patriarchal attitude of Peru. He says the average number of children born per woman in Peru is 3.5, compared with 3.1 for Latin America and 2 for the United States. Torrejon says these mothers are often single.
What is going on is that poverty does not permit stability, and for that reason, relationships are not stable. And in Peru, one of the most important problems is the lack of dads. There are no fathers in Peru. That's why most men, when a woman becomes pregnant, they leave, disappear, they are gone. Therefore, women have to take care of their children, and that's why maybe it's normal for Peru to have a house with a mother with 3, 4, 5 or more children with no father, and the mother becomes the main character of this sad story.
Not every woman in Peru fits this characterization. With the help of feminist organizations such as Demus and with their own inner strength, the women of Peru are fighting the macho culture, or machismo. Manuela Ramos is a non-profit, non-governmental organization that tries to help women in all aspects of life, including discrimination and inequality. Anna Doig is in charge of a program at Manuela Ramos called Merco Mujer, in which volunteers go out into the poor, rural areas to train women to make and sell things such as clothing.
We have cases where you can see, for example, a young woman that works with us for 10 years, and with the money she made, now she is studying at the university to become a teacher.
On average, the women trained by Merco Mujer earn $10 a month. Doig says this amount may not seem generous, but for the women living in these Andean regions, the smallest amount of money can help them get food. There are also those women who manage to succeed on their own. Maria del Carmen Vucetich from Lima is the owner of Tortas Peru, an e-business targeting the 2 million Peruvians that live outside of Peru, primarily in the United States, and who might like to send family and friends back home something with a personal touch, like a homemade torta or cake.
The idea began in the year 2000 when I went with my husband to Cusco, and I found a friend that she had 2 children and she has just divorced, and we were talking about the difficulty for a woman that has children to find a job.
Vucetich's entrepreneurial success mirrors that of a growing number of women throughout the developing world. In Peru, these women, whose cultures might have stopped them from working outside the home, are beginning to start their own businesses in the home.
The main idea was, for me, it was to get some money too and share the project with other women to know, to make this thing bigger. I knew that by myself it was not going to do as well as if I have more women working with me.
Vucetich employs 15 other women. They each profit according to how many cakes they bake each day. Women living in the small Andean villages are starting their own businesses too, even if they're on a smaller level than Tortas Peru. Berna Benavente sells everything from rice to liquor. She's been working in La Gran Ciudad village for almost 10 years. She says she dreams to move out of the village, but she cannot afford to. She says in her business there are good days when she sells a lot of things, and there are days she would prefer to stay at home because she doesn't receive any customers. But despite the hardships, these women are still working.
Now we feel that the government has forgotten us, and in this part of the country, we do not receive any support from the authorities.
Cynthia Sanborn is a professor of social sciences and politics at the Universidad del Pacífico. She says it's a lot harder for women living in small villages than it is for women living in Lima.
I think that the issue of kind of social and economic disadvantage and ethnic discrimination are both really strong, and low-income rural women are near the bottom of the heap.
Isidora Ananka Baca has a roadside stand where she sells drinks and food. She owns the business, and with the money she earns, she helps her husband with the house payments. She started the business a few months ago when the government built a new road. But business is still slow, and she and others in the village have dealt with food shortages for the last 7 years.
We don't have places where we can go and sell. We had a train crossing this way. We used to sell a lot, but now there are not as many people here. Per day I sell 1 or 2 drinks, but nothing more.
But Baca's business is evidence of progress, however small. And Professor Cynthia Sanborn says that progress is extending into government and politics.
In the political sphere, Peru has made amazing advances and has even adopted very controversial laws like a quota system in which all political parties have to have at least 25% of their candidates women or men. men. And this year they're going to start putting in process another law that even in internal primary elections, all parties have to field at least 25% candidate of the opposite sex. You know, the voters may or may not vote for them, but there are actually political scientists who've studied the results, and so far putting more women on the list has produced more women in Congress, more women in city councils and mayors. So in terms of women in public elected positions, it has advanced light years for Latin America.
Diana Portal from Demos agrees that political activity is crucial for women in Peru if they want to successfully address discrimination.
If we have women in politics, they can put into the agenda what is important for women. If we only have men, they will not care about topics important for women.
As women are becoming more involved in politics, life for women in Peru is also advancing.
Things are definitely better for women now if you compare it to things years ago. There are more rights and opportunities for women now, and we can see more professional women, and not only that, but there are women starting to organize social organizations, and they do that to fight for their rights. Years ago, we didn't see this, but now we see these women fighting for their own rights and for the rights of their families.
And Portal says in order for things to keep advancing, the women of Peru need to keep taking small steps.
The most important thing that women have here to be successful is strength. It is something that is inside the woman here. It is not something you can measure.
With the help of feminist organizations such as Demos and Manuela Ramos, more women are fighting discrimination, and women from both the city and Andean regions are venturing out into the business and political world. Advances that may further boost quality of life for women in Peru. I'm Jenny Milkowski.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Assignment Peru, a radio special produced by journalism students at the University of Illinois. I'm Matt Stenslin, one of 10 students who spent 3 weeks in Peru as part of Professor Nancy Benson's international reporting class. In the last 25 years, Peruvians have seen great changes in their country. The end of military rule, a decade of terrorism and hyperinflation, and now, an encouraging era of stability. Peruvians feel safe walking the streets and participating in social events, but there is a subtle shift taking place in this overwhelmingly Catholic country. As Acton Gordon reports, increasing numbers of Peruvians are turning away from their Catholic roots in favor of another option.
In Peru, a country where Catholicism is constitutionally recognized as the founding religion and basis for its laws, a new phenomenon is taking place, aided by Americans. 22-year-old Philip Basham of Rutherford, Texas, has recently graduated college with a degree in evangelism. He will journey to Peru to attend a 6-month evangelical missionary program in a country where Catholicism is the predominant religion and Protestants are only 15% of the population. He said the Lord called him to it.
It wasn't a big voice from the sky, but as I started reading the Bible and studying and learning and praying about it, Lord just kept opening doors and led me to be an evangelist.
American missionary Tom Fuller has been working in Peru for nearly 13 years. The 38-year-old explains why the Protestant religions are gaining momentum.
The evangelical church offers, in its particular style of worship and liturgy, an emotional part that the Catholic Church has missed quite a bit. Now, Catholic Church is changing radically, and there are some churches here that if the guy up front wasn't dressed like a priest, you wouldn't think you're in a Catholic church, because they've changed very much and are almost, they look like evangelical churches.
Professor of Sociology Guillermo Nugent at the Technical University of Catalonia in Lima believes the recent influx of evangelists within the last 2 decades is due to a collapse of the feudal order. He believes that since democracy was established in 1980, Protestant churches have flourished.
The social world that emerged after that fall of the feudal order was a modern world, a world where individual responsibility was a very central factor in your social behavior. Roman Catholicism usually don't emphasize on individual responsibility. It's more a kind of communal religion.
He says the poor education infrastructure in Peru has attracted the people to a religion that focuses on the individual's ability to read and understand the Bible.
Catholicism is looking in very other direction. I mean, the idea is that they want to stay close to the government, receive benefits, material or political, from the government. They like to figure themselves as the political mediators of society. And I would say that while Catholic Church is looking at the state, most of Protestant churches are looking at the civil society.
In Lima, Peru's capital and largest city of an estimated 9 million people, American missionary David Bredeman is a pastor at an evangelical church named Comunidad Vida. Supported by funds from the United States, the goal of the church is to target the influential upper classes of Peru. Bredeman said that there are lots of evangelical churches that fulfill the needs of the lower classes, but the upper and middle classes have been mostly ignored.
Not all of us Americans are working with the tribal people. There's really an explosion that's kind of breaking the mold of the church as it was, say, 20 years ago. Because 20 years ago, the Christian church was only for those who were poor and didn't know any better. And there are international businessmen, national political leaders. There are people with their doctorates, sometimes more than one doctorate, in law, in medicine, in other fields, who are coming to realize that, hey, this is not just for the poor Peruvians, that Jesus' blood that was shed was also shed for me.
Experts say the evangelical churches are growing the fastest with the poor people. Outside of Lima, in the slums of Villa El Salvador, the people's pain can be heard in an evangelical church called Movimiento Misionero Mundial. A lady named Rosalia explains what she has seen at the church since she's been there.
Every person who comes here lives with psychological problems, very traumatized. Having gone to the psychologist, psychiatrist, we now know that Western medicine and human science has not been able to help us. We are looking for a place in which we can find our sanity.
Sofia Keys grew up in a strict Catholic household. She said along with her own issues, her parents were constantly fighting with each other and her brother was an alcoholic.
And I saw on top of the table a knife. I thought I want to kill myself. I thought, why continue to live? I didn't want to continue to see my parents' marriage fall apart. It was the worst thing that could have happened to me. I had seen this happen in my friends in different places, but seeing it happen to my family was something different. It was then that I decided to take my life. I didn't feel that my mother was supportive and didn't understand me. In fact, she did a lot of psychological damage to me. I wanted to kill myself, but at that moment, it was as if something and the Lord made me remember the beautiful things I had learned and started as a child.
When church services begin, grief is replaced by song and praise. Protestants in Peru are penetrating the small towns all over, such as Aguas Calientes. The Seventh-day Adventists have been holding services for 6 months out of an old store next to the main shopping square. Their move into the town is significant because they are the first Protestant church to establish a presence at the base of one of Peru's most important landmarks, Machu Picchu.
Machu Picchu was a poverty-stricken area. The people worked in precarious conditions, they had no way of developing their economy, and now they've discovered a medium, tourism. However, these people have not used this medium to construct their lives in a personal aspect. Instead, they've been using all their money to prioritize their tradition, to put their traditions on higher planes. They're saints.
And on the occasional night at an evangelical church in Cusco, there are concerts that mix the traditional sounds from ancient Incan flutes with modern instruments. The sounds pour into the streets loud enough for the people walking by to stop and listen. Pedro Catalan is the pastor.
The evangelical church now has national leadership. We're self-sustained and no longer depend on missionaries. We appreciate their effort for letting us see the light of the truth. With word in hand, that word has reached our hearts, our minds, and it has transformed us. It has opened our eyes to allow us to see who is Christ and what Christ wants from us.
The Protestant movement has not gone unseen by Catholics. Sister Sally Harper, a Catholic nun with St. John's Parish in Lima, believes that the inability of the Catholic Church to maintain its congregation is due to its large size.
You've got one priest, or you've got one group of four sisters that attend, and they're 10,000 people. There's no way you can know 10,000 people.
And she says evangelical leaders seem to connect better to their following than Catholic clergy.
I think that the structure of the Catholic Church is much more clerical. That means there's priests. I don't have anything against priests. But most priests go to school like a doctor. They're like study for 7, 8, 9 years to become a priest. So they tend to be, if you're going to spend a whole lot of time in the classroom, you're going to tend to be pretty, you know, in your head.
Not all Catholic leaders believe the Protestant evangelical movement is having a big impact, like Father Juan Mendoza, the pastor of a Catholic church in Lima.
There are little tiny churches or movement that came from foreign countries. The reaction or the feeling, it can be, well, they are growing a lot. But I don't think so. I think that, yes, there are coming some churches from outside, but there are not so many.
Additionally, Father Juan believes the Catholic Church is still the traditional place for the poor and the suffering to go when they need help.
As poor people, they don't go to the mayor. They don't go to the government. They go where the doors are open.
Despite the differences in opinion as to whether the Protestants are gaining momentum in Peru or not, one thing is for certain. There are more Protestant churches in Peru now than there was just a decade ago, and American missionaries continue to invest money to spread the gospel. Acton Gorton, reporting.
Even though Peru is one of the strongest economies in Latin America, President Alejandro Toledo's approval rating is among the lowest in the region. It's in the single digits. Toledo is not getting much credit for what is working in Peru, but he is getting the blame for the problems. Peruvians will choose a new president in 2006. Under Peru's system of government, that means changes from top to bottom. Gladys Valerio reports.
On April 9, 2006, the future of Peru will be in the hands of a new president. In Peru, this means big change in all major institutions. There is no tradition of civil service employees in Peru, so when a new government is elected, most people are removed from their jobs at schools, hospitals, even in the military service, so party loyalists can take over. As you might imagine, this causes a huge disruption. Institute of Peruvian Studies political scientist Julio Cutler says this means the new government starts from scratch.
Everybody is Adam. Each president is an Adam that want to be the first man on the earth. There is no continuity because you don't have institutions that enforce the law and be able to make some kind of prolongation.
This instability has many Peruvians unsatisfied with the government. In 2001, Peruvians elected President Alejandro Toledo, a novice who grew up in poverty in rural Peru, but earned an advanced degree in economics at Stanford in the U.S. Toledo won the election after former President Alberto Fujimori resigned in the midst of a corruption scandal. Cutler says even though the economy has improved since President Toledo came to power, the public doesn't like it.
Toledo's government maintained the fiscal equilibrium, all the orthodox recommendations, so that we have a sustained economic growth during all this time, but he hasn't any political organization behind him. So all his government was quite unstable, and he is particularly incompetent.
Toledo can't be re-elected because of a law that prohibits consecutive terms. The fear of Peru slipping into dictatorship is high. Toledo is the first president of indigenous background to win the presidency of Peru. Some say his ethnic background is a cause of his unpopularity. But the director of the Institute of Peruvian Studies, Martin Tanaka, says it's not the president's ethnicity but corruption scandals and ineffectual government that have made him extremely unpopular. It's the same fate as other Peruvian presidents. 47-year-old Emilio Espinosa is a cab driver in Lima. He notes that over 50% of Peruvians live in poverty. Espinosa says that proves economic stability is only benefiting the upper class, and for him, as for most Peruvians, living on an annual salary of about $700 is barely enough to survive.
I can't go to Miraflores right now to buy myself some pants that cost 150 sols. Why? Because I don't have enough money. I don't make that amount of money. I have a family, college to pay, food, health care, recreation, mortgage, and it's just not enough.
During his campaign, President Toledo promised to fight corruption, implement educational reforms, guarantee judicial independence, and cut military spending. Teaching assistant Julio Naro says Toledo made too many promises that haven't been kept. Naro works at an elementary school in Villa El Salvador, one of the poor districts around Lima.
There are so many things that need to be done in education. For example, soul kitchens for children. There are so many kids suffering of malnutrition because they don't have a lunch. That's what worries us. He needs to be more concerned for our education. The education system is the most forgotten.
The dissatisfaction with the current government also exists in cities other than Lima. Pablo Gonzalez is an economist who works for the municipality of Machu Picchu Pueblo. He says the government isn't reaching out to towns like Machu Picchu Pueblo and the 12 Indian villages surrounding it. He says these villages aren't benefiting from Peru's economic growth.
These smaller communities don't feel the development. This growth is mainly benefiting smaller groups that are in power, the traditional families that own Peru.
Gonzalez says the majority of these villages have no running water or electricity. This is the case of Ciudad Villa Grande, a village populated by indigenous people where the main language is not Spanish, but Quechua. Ciudad Villa Grande is the town of Edna Travente, who owns one of the village's few grocery stores, a store she opened in her own house. She says the central government is not supporting them.
In that sense, I think that the government has forgotten about us. I think that there is more support on the north side of the country than here in the mountains. We are a little forgot.
But there are some people who say Toledo's government has done an outstanding job. Eric Lavalle is a law student in one of the top universities in Lima. He says the government is just settling the stage for the development of Peru and that people need to be more patient.
Peru needs a plan of about 20 years to be able to get out of this. So many Peruvians are not willing to wait those 20 years. That's why these 5 years are an economic transition.
The director for the Institute of Peruvian Studies, Martin Tanaka, also says Peruvians are too critical of the current government.
We have a government that has inherited many of the problems from past decades, and it has inherited weakness in political parties, weakness in the different institutions which are expressed in the government, as well as in the opposition.
Regardless of what Peruvians think of their government, they don't have the option of staying home on election day. About 16 million Peruvians over the age of 18 are expected to vote next April. And unless they live in remote villages without access to a polling place, they're required by law to get a number ID card and vote or face a fine of about $45. There are currently 30 presidential candidates to choose from, with only four considered viable candidates. Polls show that the leftist Christian political party candidate Lourdes Flores is leading with 23% support. She lost to President Toledo in the last runoff election. If elected, she would be Peru's first woman president.
I do think that being a woman represents a change, but I do think at the same time that we have simple, very touch-to-floor ideas. I won't promise what I cannot afford. I won't do any populism.
While a majority favors Flores, the second favorite in the polls is former President Alan Garcia, the candidate of one of Peru's main political parties, APRA. The director of the Institute of Peruvian Studies, Martin Tanaka, says even though Garcia's government was bad, some people still remember its positives.
He used government money to create populist policies that generated inflation, but at the same time, it generated jobs, housing programs. Yes, it was a bad government, but it created economic bases. That doesn't make it despicable.
20-year-old Gabriela Andrien Cel is a first-time voter. She says even though she has very low expectations for the upcoming election, she's still very excited to finally be part of the political world of Peru.
Honestly, my expectations for next year are not very good. I feel like there isn't anyone that really inspires me to participate or be actively supportive because I belong to the political movement or anyone who has the same ideas or rhetoric I have.
Political scientist Julio Kotler says voters have many options for this election, but the political instability in Peru makes its future uncertain. He says he doesn't see an easy way to integrate development and politics in Peru. But he hopes voters will be educated and familiar with the issues when they go to the polls on April 9, 2006.
That was Gladys Valerio reporting. In two of the last four presidential races, Peruvians elected an unknown come-from-behind candidate, a political dark horse. Insiders say that makes it impossible to predict, at this early stage, who might be elected the next president of Peru. There will be many challenges for the next administration. Literacy rates are rising, and the unemployment rate is dropping as more people migrate from the mountains and the jungle to the outskirts of Lima. But it will take a lot more money to bring clean water, electricity, and plumbing to the more than 50% of Peruvians living in poverty. This concludes Assignment Peru, a two-hour special produced by journalism students at the University of Illinois. There are lots of people to acknowledge. We'd like to thank the University of Illinois Center for International Business Education and Research for underwriting the trip. We'd also like to thank the journalism faculty and students at Universidad Peruana de Ciencias Aplicadas for their support and help, especially Dean Ursula Freund and journalism students Gonzalo Parares and Carlos Andres. We'd also like to thank University of Illinois Professor Alberto Nieto. Thanks for listening. I'm Matt Stensley.